Morning.
Good morning. It is 9 a.m. This is the Senate Finance Committee. Today is Tuesday, January 27th. If you're listening at home, we're in Juneau at the Capitol in the Senate Finance Room of 532. Today, the Senate Finance Committee will hear from Janik Mayer and Nikos Taphos, consultants for the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. Their company's name is Analytica. With me this morning, Senator Bishop, Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, and myself, Senator Fairclough. If I could ask Mr. Mayer and Mr. Taphos to please join us at the microphones. Identify yourself for the record. And again, for those listening at home, we are going to talk about the impacts of oil and gas production and tax credits at low oil prices. Welcome.
Madam Chair, thank you. For the record, Janik Mayer, partner in Analytica. It's a great pleasure to be back here in front of Senate Finance once again. For myself, it's my fourth session spending time at this testimony table, having spent much time over the last several years talking, first of all, about oil and gas tax reform, and then more recently last year about the Alaska LNG project. We have two substantial papers that we have prepared on issues today, one being on a sort of background piece on oil prices and recent movements in the markets and the fundamental causes of some of those things, and the other being about the impact of those low oil prices on tax credits in the Alaska's production tax system. We want to walk through a sort of overview presentation of some of those issues today. With that, I will hand over to my colleague Nikos to talk about oil prices to start.
Mr. Mayer, if I could pause for a minute. My staff and the staff in the finance room properly informed me that my name is McKinnon now, so Senator McKinnon chairing, and we and for those at home, I was married this a few months ago, and adapting to that in these surroundings is a bit difficult for everyone. We've also been joined by Senator Machicki right after the gavel was brought down. Welcome, Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Taphos, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, everyone. For the record, my name is Nikos Taphos, a partner at Analytica. My background is I spent the last about 10 years working in the oil and gas industry, for the most part as a consultant to it, worked on a number of issues and with a number of companies, primarily focusing around gas marketing, commercialization, but also increasingly on energy economics more broadly. And so I want to put that hat on for this morning as I walk you through a few of the slides that we have prepared for you today. So the first three slides of this presentation come from a paper that, as my colleague Janik said, we've just made available to the committee. And the intention is to try to make sense of what's happening in the oil market. So I spend a lot of my time in a consulting firm, so I want to sort of share with you how someone whose job it is to make sense of oil markets is thinking about what's happening today. My goal is not to tell you whether the price of oil is going to be 40, 45, or 50, but I want to tell you what are the kind of things that someone in that position is looking at to try to make sense of what's going on. Okay? So let's start with the first slide, and I'm going to use the laser pointer to walk you through some of these things. The biggest issue in the oil market over the last few years has been the boom in oil production in the United States, which really means the lower 48. As you can see on the chart on the left, relative to January 2010, the United States has added almost 5 million barrels a day of additional production. Okay, so that is essentially shale or tight oil from a few regions, and we'll talk about that. But basically, there's just been a huge boom. Just for reference, for a reminder, you know, the world market is about 90-odd million barrels a day. So adding five is a big deal. Okay, now, as the U.S. was doing that, it seemed that whenever the U.S. was adding oil to the market, something happened elsewhere in the world to take oil off the market. I'm not talking about deliberate action by OPEC. I'm talking about accidents, civil wars, or matters of policy. So if you go again to the left chart, what you see is the red line is what the U.S. was adding. The green line is what the Energy Information Administration calls unplanned outages. So basically shut in production for a number of reasons. And so you can see it was sort of minimal, and then it really shoots up. That's the civil war in Libya. It takes a lot of market, a lot of oil off the market. Then it kind of stabilizes, and Libya comes back, so that falls. And then it sort of keeps growing again, a little bit of Libya. And then the Syrian civil war starts, so Syrian oil comes off the market. And then the U.S. and its allies tighten sanctions on Iran, so some of the Iranian crude comes off the market. So you can basically see that by the middle of 2013, whatever the U.S. had added, someone else had taken off the market. And so in a way, you had this huge boom in production, but you didn't see the benefit in pricing because there was some event somewhere in the world that was offsetting what the U.S. was doing. Okay, and then you get to about the middle of 2013, and you can see it sort of stabilizes. And then you see the last part, which is right here in 14, really coming down. And that's mostly Libyan production coming back into the market. And so you can see on the left-hand chart, you know, the U.S. keeps doing what it's doing, no big change there. But rather than having the rest of the world or these countries offsetting what the U.S. was doing, you get to the point where the outage is stabilized, and actually they fall, which means more production starts coming into the market. So if you translate that into the middle chart, which shows you actually the global production for oil, and we put a little bit of history there just to give you a sense of how things were going. I don't really want to talk about things until 2009 or 10. But you can see from 11 to 12, there's very little production growth. And then in, from 10 to 11, there was very little production growth. And then in 12, there was a lot of production, right? And the 12, this was the drop here where more oil was hitting the market. And then for the last, you know, from 12, 13, there was very little growth. And this is this dynamic here. Whatever the U.S. was adding, someone else was taking off. And then by the time these outages stopped and oil started coming into the market, you see a huge jump in production from 2013 to 2014, you know, almost 1.5 million barrels, right? So that's the supply picture. The supply picture is U.S. booming, rest of the world offsetting because of accidents or sanctions, etc. At some point, that stops. That oil starts coming back into the market, and so suddenly you have a ton of supply that hits the market. That's the supply picture. Now, at roughly the same time, remember the drop in the price of oil really started around the summer, right? So it's really the last 6 months of 2014 that the price of oil fell. And so the last chart shows you, this is the forecast for demand done by the International Energy Agency. The International Energy Agency is an agency of the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. It was set up after the oil shocks as a forum for developed countries to coordinate energy policy. And they put out an oil market outlook every month that everyone in the industry reads. Okay? And so what this shows you is how they thought about the market demand across the year. So the way to read this chart is, you know, in January 2014, their forecast for 2014 was that the market was going to grow by 1.4%. Okay? And you can see that for the first 6 months, they kind of thought, you know what, market is going to grow this year by 1.4%. And then something happened around the middle of the year, right here, and you had a huge decline. Part of it was slowdown in China, the pullback of quantitative easing by the Fed, crisis in the Eurozone, Japan being very slow, just a bunch of basically broad economic news. And you know how sentiment works. When things start going bad, everyone just kind of freaks out, right? And so you can see that basically the expectation went that the market, instead of growing 1.4%, was only going to go 0.6%. And in fact, 2015, the initial expectation was, well, 2015 is going to grow by 1.4%, and that progressively came down as well. So if you think about that, you do a little bit of mental math, you lose in 2014 about 1 percentage point, right? So this is a 90 million barrel a day market, so you lose about 900,000 barrels a day, okay, 1%. And then for 2015, you lose about 0.5 percentage point because you went from an expectation of 1.5 to 1. So suddenly, the supply that was flat is growing by 1.5 million barrels a day, and the demand expectation, which was robust, has fallen by 1.5 million barrels a day. So this combination, this switch, is why basically there was a huge free fall in the price of oil from the perspective of fundamentals. Both excess supply and really bearish demand came at just the same time to create an enormous sort of pressure onto the oil price.
Mr. Safos, thank you for pausing. We have a question. I would like to welcome Co-Chairman Kelly as well as Senator Dunleavy to the table, to the committee. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On your last slide on the right, the forecast for 2015, how far does that go out into the future in 2015?
Thank you, Senator Harmon, through the chair. So what this is it's a slightly difficult graph. So basically every month, it's the forecast for that year. So the green line is the forecast for 2015, just for 2014. The green line is for 2014, as it evolves every month, right? So this is just the growth for 2014. And the red line is just the growth for 2015. So basically the way to read this is in August or July, the IEA said that 2015, oil demand was going to grow by 1.4, 1.5%. And by the end of the year, again, the expectation for 2015, they had revised that down just 1%. So this is purely looking at this year and the next year. It's not necessarily a forecast for next 3-4 years. This is really capturing today's market sentiment for the next 12 to 18 months. Usually, the International Energy Agency introduces the next year forecast in the middle of the year. So that's as far as they go in their short-term outlook. They have other outlooks, medium-term and long-term, but they're not updated quite as frequently. So this is really the best way to gauge month to month how things are changing.
Is there any other questions from committee members? Senator Machicki.
Just a comment. I mean, it's counterintuitive, but it all represents growth. It's just lower than predicted growth.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Would it be fair to say that the U.S. has been benefiting by increased production and the rest of the market hadn't been affected because we were watching world chaos, either unexpected natural occurrences, war, as you said before, sanctions, and that now we're seeing that stabilize and those other markets are coming back online with the U.S. production, and so we're seeing much more oil available in a somewhat weaker global market as far as using the oil?
Senator McKinnon, absolutely. The way I would think about it is, so the U.S. was benefiting because, you know, this growth in production, and obviously Alaska knows this very well, you know, it brings jobs, it brings well-paying jobs, it brings a number of side benefits. So the U.S. had that benefit. It didn't necessarily have the benefit of cheaper oil because what happened was, you know, WTI, which is sort of the U.S. price or the U.S. Midlands price, you know, that fell. But consumers at the end of the day still pay international prices. So what really happened was this was sort of a new golden age for refiners because refiners were basically able to arbitrage between cheaper U.S. oil and more expensive internationally priced products, which is what the consumer was paying. So I would say the U.S. was definitely benefiting. The benefit hadn't quite trickled down throughout the entire chain to go to the American consumer. And that really happened once, as you say, the market stabilized and prices fell. And so that's where you're seeing the impact at the pump for the consumer.
Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know if Iraq is producing at peak production, or has their civil war curtailed scale that back?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy. So Iraq is, there are two ways to answer that question is, you know, if you go back 3-4 years and you look at what people hoped Iraq was going to do, Iraq is way off.
Way off of peak production potential.
Absolutely. From peak production in terms of where they hope and they, I mean, for the Iraqis, in their mind, they should be producing as much as Saudi Arabia.
Okay. Right. Can I do a follow-up, please?
Please. Please, Senator.
I'm just going to go down the list here. Syria is not a peak production.
Absolutely not.
Libya is not a peak production.
Mm-hmm.
Is Iran at peak production?
No, Iran. Sorry, through the chair, and Senator Donnelly, Iran is not, but that's because of sanctions.
Right, but my point is, a number of large producers are not at peak production.
Yes.
Yet the price is being driven down by oversupply.
Mm-hmm.
If they were to come online, theoretically, one would tend to think that the price would be driven down even further because there'd be even more supply.
Senator Donnelly, Chair, correct. Everything else being equal, which in the oil market it never is, but yes.
So many folks, and we like to be an optimistic bunch, are predicting oil. Well, some folks are predicting oil going up dramatically next year or the year after. Some of these are the same folks that did not predict that oil would drop like it did this year. If those folks come on, if those countries come online, given the economics that we know, is it unreasonable to expect low oil prices for some time?
Senator Donnelly, through the chair, if you will allow me, can I answer that question after two slides? I just want to run through sort of the complete picture of the oil market and tell you how we think about, you know, what will trigger a reversal. Okay?
Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is the picture, which then breeds the next question, which is, where's OPEC? What's OPEC doing? And so we would like to turn to the next slide, which really talks about OPEC. And this is it's a heavy slide, but hopefully it's going to be an illustrative slide. And the key point we want to convey here is that contrary to what you may get from reading the press, OPEC doesn't really control the price of oil. And so I want to throw that big statement out there, and I want to run you through why we think that is. But first, let me orient you through this slide, because there's a lot of stuff going on. Okay? So the top chart shows OPEC's market share since 1965. So this is purely OPEC production divided by global production. Okay? Now, the one thing, it doesn't really matter, but just in case anyone tries to replicate this chart, the composition of OPEC has changed over time. Countries have come into the organization, countries have come out. So this is what we call a shifting composition. So every year, you just look at who's part of OPEC, and you add up their production. The next part shows you the quotas. So the chief mechanism through which OPEC tries to manage the market is to set quotas, which basically says how much production OPEC countries are going to produce. The quotas were introduced in 1982. So OPEC was founded in 1960, but it wasn't until 1982 that they formally introduced quotas. And you can also see, based on the different colors, that at different times, different countries have agreed to the quotas. Right. So for a long period of time, you can see the yellows. It's ex-Iraq, so either because of the Iran-Iraq war or because of sanctions, Iraq has basically been exempted from quotas. You can see at other times that, you know, in the Gulf War, Iraq and Kuwait were both out of the quotas because they were fighting a war. At points, Iran and Iraq have disagreed. So you can see that quotas is not really a, you know, all of OPEC kind of concept. It's really who can sit around the table and agree kind of concept, right? So the reason that the second chart is helpful is because it kind of shows you what OPEC is doing. So let me walk you through sort of a 3 or 4 minute history of OPEC in those terms. So basically, in our understanding, OPEC has tried to do three things throughout its history. It has tried basically in the 70s up to the mid 80s to set the price. Okay, and what that did is basically, you know, OPEC's market share kept increasing because there was a huge growth in production, and then it sort of stabilized. This stabilization was not necessarily intentional. It was more some countries increasing, other countries falling off. Interestingly enough, the countries falling off would be Iran, Libya, Venezuela. So not much has changed since the 1970s in that regard. And then at some point, as OPEC really tried to keep prices up, it was only able to do so by surrendering market share. So you basically say, well, how do I keep prices up? I cut production. So more production comes on, Alaska, North Sea, Mexico, some oil from the Soviet Union. So the only way to do it is just keep cutting, cut. So you get to the point where
you know, you used to have a market share of 55%, and now you have a market share of 30%. And so, yes, you're keeping prices high, but you're not producing enough to make money. So what's the point? So at that point, what happened is basically Saudi Arabia said, enough, they were the ones cutting, everyone else was benefiting, and said, you know what, doesn't work for us, we're going to turn it up and start producing. And so that led to the price crash in 1986. So at that point, basically from about 86 to the Asian financial crisis in the late 90s, OPEC was really following the market. And you can see, you know, it was just kind of producing a little bit more as the market was rising. You can see that in its quotas. All the quotas are basically kind of going up or stabilizing. You're just trying to add production to the market as the market needs it. And then at some point you get to the Asian financial crisis, the Russian financial crisis, a number of events in the late 90s, where OPEC sort of tries to stabilize the market. You can see this in the quotas, right? So it had a quota of about, you know, 27 million barrels. It really drops it. It drops it again. And then you have 2001, where basically every month they cut production. This is, you know, you look at this chart here, this is what we call active management. So every month you get together and say, you know what, we need to cut a little bit more, we need to cut a little bit more, we need to cut a little bit more. So what happened at that time is, you know, they cut too much and then they overproduced, and basically there was just an up and down jumble in the oil price, because just when they thought they got it right, they realized that they didn't, so they had to make another tweak. So you're just sitting around trying to guess what OPEC's going to do. So at some point, they realized about 3 years later, you know what, this just doesn't work, because we can't micromanage the oil market so much. And so they kind of give up. And so they go back to a period of just following the oil market. And so you can see they stabilize quotas, then they increase quotas, and they basically just try to increase quotas. And then they get to the point about 2006, 2007, where they say, you know what, this whole quota thing, I mean, just produce as much as you can, because the price is so high, we just need all the oil we can get. And then you come to the financial crisis, the most recent one, and you can see OPEC sort of going through a series of cuts and then making more dramatic cuts. So going basically from about 30 million barrels of production at the onset of the crisis, you know, before Lehman Brothers, all the way down to about 25, right? So this was, again, a time where they really stepped in and said, you know what, price of oil has gone from 150 to 40. We need to step in to arrest that. And so you can see them doing that. And then basically it comes to a point where they said, you know what, you know, we've stabilized, they've increased the quota to about 30 million, they've just kept it there. We're going through this history of OPEC just to underscore a couple of things. First, basically since the late 80s or the mid 80s, OPEC hasn't tried to manage the price in such an active way, right? What it has done is a couple of times when there's been a near-term shock, mostly to demand, it's tried to step in to put a floor underneath, right? Whether that was the Asian financial crisis or the financial crisis that started with, you know, Lehman, spread to the Eurozone, and so on and so forth. But for the most part of its history, basically OPEC has been following the market, just adding a little bit of supply as supply is needed in order to keep sort of volatility down and prices stabilized. Now, the key thing to understand from this chart is, in a big way, what OPEC is thinking is, they're thinking that the real analogy to what's happening today is the experience, this experience of the 70s and 80s. Because at that point, what happened is, you know, the price of oil had really gone up because of the oil shocks. First, the embargo in 73, and then the Iran-Iraq war and Iran revolution. So this made oil really expensive. A bunch of places, including Alaska, said, hey, we can make some money here, started adding oil into the market. And so the way that OPEC thinks about this is that, look, when the price of oil is high enough that a bunch of new supply comes into the market, there's nothing we can really do to stop that. Because the only way to stop that is to lower our production and accept a lower market share. So what they did in the 70s and 80s, you know, didn't stop Alaska, didn't stop the North Sea. It just allowed all this production to keep coming. So in Saudi Arabia, in particular mind, what they see is that trying to basically cut production, all it will do is give a big green light to folks in North Dakota and Texas to keep drilling. And they say, why do that? It's just a losing game. You can see it playing out. The only way for us to win is to produce less and less and less. So this is how OPEC is really thinking about this. So now I want to go to the last slide, talk about the other side to this, which is the U.S. And because really this is about, you know, OPEC versus U.S. in a way, and so I want to run you through a little bit how we think about that. This is the last slide of the oil markets presentation. And the three things we wanted to highlight, and they're explained a little bit more in our paper, so our apologies for the brevity on the slide, but there's a paper that you can read. It's just three or four pages, kind of like explaining some of these things, so hopefully that'll be a good compliment, absolutely. So the three key words are scalable, diffuse, and variable. These are the three things to know about U.S. oil production. Let me walk through each one. Scalable. I mean, this is incredible. If you look at this picture, right, you look at the Eagle Ford, for the most part in Texas, and you go from basically nothing in January 2010 to 1.6, 1.7 million barrels a day now, right? This doesn't happen in the world of oil. We actually went and checked, and if you include Alaska, because Alaska had a similar trajectory, basically went from almost zero to over a million barrels. You know, it happened in Libya, and it happened in the North Sea. Those are the only two places that within a span of 2-3 years have gone from zero to a million barrels. It just doesn't happen in the oil and gas industry, right? So the scale of this is enormous, and you can see that it's not one, it's three areas that do that. The Bakken, this is North Dakota, Permian, again, Texas. So the Permian had a lot of conventional oil production, and then it just added about another million barrels a day, again, relative to 2010, 2011. So this is really important. I'll talk about the importance of this once we go through all the three parameters. Diffuse is really interesting, and you'll appreciate this if you think about the contrast with Alaska. So if you look in Texas, the top operator in Texas produces less than 10% of the state's oil production. The top 30 producers in Texas produce two-thirds of the state's oil production. 30 companies, two-thirds of total, which means that you need to really go 50, 60, 70, 80 players to actually get the entire picture, right? So this is not like Alaska where you have, you know, three or four or five players that account for almost all the production. This is extremely diffuse, and this matters, and I'll get to that in a sec. The last thing, it's incredibly variable. What that means is that you can have one well next to the other, and one could be 30 times more productive than its neighbor. Huge variation. And this is really the property of what shale gas and shale oil or tight oil really look like. So why, how do we think about these three things in the context of the oil market? Now, let me take you back to the beginning of the presentation. I said I was going to share with you how someone whose job is to forecast oil prices thinks about the future. And I've been in enough of those sessions in my various years as a consultant. And in some ways, the job is very easy. The job was easy not because you're going to get it right, but because you knew what to look for. And someone in the job of forecasting oil prices in 2010 or 2011 was really thinking about two numbers. They were thinking about what is the marginal barrel, what is the most expensive oil out there, and at what price does it need in order to come online. And that marginal barrel, for the most part, was either in the deep water, Brazil, Angola, elsewhere, or it was Canadian oil sands. So if you're trying to figure out the marginal barrel, the most expensive oil, all you need to do is forecast about 30 or 40 projects to try to understand the economics of those projects. So it's a relatively simple exercise. Janek has done quite a bit of it. And that's what you would do as a consultant. So that's the first data point you would look at. The second data point you would look at is you would say, what is the quote-unquote fiscal break-even of OPEC countries, which is a way of saying, at what oil price do countries like Saudi Arabia in particular feel the pain? Because that, the assumption is, tells you at what price they'll step in to do something about it, right? And that's usually how they balance their budgets on how, or how they balance their external accounts, imports and exports. So all you had to do was come up with these two numbers, and it gave you more or less the floor for oil prices. You said, you know what? If the marginal barrel is 70 to 80 and Saudi Arabia's fiscal break-even is 70 to 80, 70 to 80 is a floor. Because if you go below that, either Saudi's going to step in or Canadian oil sands are going to stop producing or stop being sanctioned, or deep water oil is going to stop getting sanctioned. So that was the logic. You just came up with that floor and you made a long-term forecast based on that. And this is where the lower 48 just completely destroys that logic, right? Because when you think about these three adjectives, scalable, it's like, wow, within 3 years, you can have out of nowhere 1.5 million barrels a day of production. That really messes up your forecasting ability, right? Because the pace of change is just so quick, right? You think about AKLNG, right? We're talking today, hoping to have first gas in 2024, right? So this is how oil and gas industry normally works. You plan today, hoping to have oil and gas in 5, 7, 10 years. In this case, you go from 0 to 1.5 million barrels a day, that's basically Libya, within the span of 3 years. That makes forecasting very difficult. The second part is diffuse. Remember I said, top 30 companies in Texas produce only 2/3 of the total production. So, you know, you sit in Alaska and you say, well, what's going to happen in Alaska? Well, you know, you talk to BP, you talk to Exxon, you talk to Conoco, you talk to a few other players, you get a good sense of what they're thinking and, you know, where they're standing. In Texas, you know, you have to think about 50 or 60 different players, different incentives, different capital structures, different abilities to deploy capital, different debt levels. So it's a very difficult thing to make sense out of, especially if you think that there are three of those places that account for the bulk of the production. So you may have upwards of 100 players that you really need to think about, what are these guys going to do now? You know, what is their break even? It's like, well, you know, the break even from an economic perspective may be 40 or 50, but maybe these guys have debt that they need to pay back, and if they don't produce, they're going to go bankrupt. So maybe they're willing to take a lower price in order to avoid bankruptcy. So it gets much more difficult, you know, when you're sitting there as an oil forecasting analyst thinking, oh, I can just think about the break-even price of a few Canadian oil sands projects in deep water or the break-even price of OPEC. Now suddenly you have to get into the weeds of 100 different players taking decisions that are very sort of not necessarily in concert with one another. And the last thing is variable. We saw this in gas. So because gas has the same variability in production as oil, what you saw in the financial crisis is the rig count, which is a proxy of activity, in the U.S. basically fell by half, right? So price of gas fell, people cut activity, they stopped drilling. And what happened to production? Absolutely nothing. So the activity fell by half, and absolutely nothing happened to production. Why? Because there's such variability that you just cut really, really, really bad wells. So you can cut a lot of really bad wells, it doesn't make a difference, right, if you still keep drilling the good wells. Let's step back. Why are we going through all this? Going through all this to underscore that how much more difficult it's getting to really understand the dynamics in the oil market, that a lot of the models that the industry has relied upon to think about this aren't well suited to the new world. They aren't well suited to the world of this type of pace, so quick change. It's not suited to modeling 100 different players scattered all over the United States. It's not modeled in thinking about not break-even prices from a, you know, textbook economic sense, but break-even prices in the real world, where people respond to all sorts of different incentives. And so that makes things very difficult. Now, having said that, and I'm very mindful, and Senator Dunleavy is going to jump in and tell me, why did you say this? the consensus is if you look at not just the break-even price, but really, you know, the best wells, what do they need in order to be economic? So if you think about, so let's put aside demand for a second. How does production respond to low oil prices? It responds in two ways. Either because you don't think you're going to make money, and so you're not going to drill more, or because you don't have money, right? So, you know, if you are a company that used to have maybe profit net income of 20 or 30 or 40 billion dollars, and suddenly you have 15, just like Alaska, you're going to look at the budget, and you're going to say, okay, I need to cut. I need to think about how to make adjustments. I can't afford all the things that I was doing last year. And so those are the two ways in which production adjusts. Either you don't sanction projects because they're not economic, or you don't sanction or you don't produce things because you just don't have money. So if you look at that, those two things together, it seems that around 40 to 50 is the price where you have cash negative on existing operations, and new stuff doesn't look particularly attractive. And so that is why there's a sense that, you know, $40, $50 seems to be a more or less floor. Now, I want to come back to Senator Dunleavy's question, which is, okay, now we've stabilized, this is great. What if tomorrow the U.S. and Iran announce a deal on nuclear weapons and another million barrels of oil from Iran comes onto the market? And so the answer to that is price would fall further, but that would basically push a lot of these guys to really cut back, right? Because you just get to the point where it's just not economic. So you'll have actually, if you go back to the initial chart, you'll have the inverse where the averages are falling, so there's more production, but the U.S. is falling as well because you just don't have enough cash. A lot of these companies are smaller players. You know, they don't have big balance sheets. If they don't have cash, they're just not going to produce. And so that's more or less the way we're thinking about that. So you may have more downward pressure on the price if some of this oil hits the market, but you're getting now to a low level of price that really the marginal barrels just can't keep producing.
Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just love listening to you guys talk.
Senator Bishop, could I get you to use your mic?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Okay, question. When would the Monterey Shale come into play on this chart that you got?
Not sure.
Okay. Second thing is, on the, you got your three variables up here, and listening to everything that you've just been talking about, especially under Diffuse, you got multiple players, and it's a new paradigm and all that. When do you think they're the bigger players? Because I read the history of oil. And now we see history repeating itself here. And I just wrote a fourth one up here, acquisition.
Senator Bishop, through the chair, you're absolutely right. So what we saw in gas is as prices went down, you know, some of these producers became financially strapped, and so they sold out, went bankrupt. The other thing that really happened was, again, if you step back in the history of oil, you know, about 10 years ago, the majors basically wrote off North America. And so they said, you know what, we can't grow production there. We have to go elsewhere in the world. And so as they went elsewhere in the world, all these small independents figured it out, and they start producing. So out of nowhere, all the majors said, hey, North America is big. We should go back. And so they came back. Some of the European majors, like Total, Statoil, Eni, came in. Some of the Chinese companies came in. This is both Lower 48 as well as Western Canada. And so you absolutely are right that you will have some of this diffusion gets consolidated at some point. But it doesn't, we haven't quite seen it even in the more established gas plays. It never quite gets to as high a level as a conventional basin like in Alaska. There's a couple of reasons for that. First is, I mean, you think about your leases, right? The blocks that you offer. You know, a block that Alaska offers to the market for a bidder to bid on, you know, that same parcel of land in the lower 48 would be cut up in 40, 50, 60 different pieces, right? So the point is that you can't go to Texas and lease a parcel of land this big without going to each individual landowner, knocking on their door, and getting them to sign a lease. So it's a much more intensive and difficult process. So the accumulation of big acreage is a lot more difficult, because for the most part you talk about one square acre lease. And so to amass a huge area, it really takes a long time. And by the time you go knocking all these doors, someone else is knocking right behind you, right before you, signing them up. And so there's an inherent limit to how much you can accumulate by virtue of just how segmented the parcels are.
Senator Bishop, follow up.
Thank you.
Senator Dunleavy.
To the chair, thank you. I don't think I'm going to ask you that question, but that you predicted, just to not let you win on that one. But so a couple things I've heard that I need some clarification on. Previous to this, we really didn't know. And now what you're saying is we really don't know, because it's a whole new world, correct?
Yes.
But then you said you think the market dynamics will get us to a point of, I think you said, somewhere in the neighborhood of $40 or $50 dollars a barrel.
Yes.
And so when you come to that conclusion, and trust me, we're not going to hold you to that, okay? But when you come to that, so we're pushing Keystone. If Keystone gets passed, that takes care of the bottleneck for oil sands. People will say that the oil sands are uneconomical, but at the same time, there's another dynamic that cheap energy, which you need to cook the oil sands, makes it cheaper to cook the oil sands. So maybe they will, in fact, produce, which will put much more oil on the market. But where is the, in this calculus, is the corresponding increase in supply of gas? Because since oil started to go through the roof, my understanding is there have been conversions from off of oil in many sectors of not just industry, but across society, from oil to gas. And so you have another type of energy put into the system that competes with oil as well. So we now have more gas competing with oil, because as you remember last year when we were talking, it was $107 a barrel oil was. Gas was pretty low in terms of its cost. So how does that play of gas benefiting from the same technology going into the market impact potential future oil prices, in addition to all of this demand or all of this supply we say is happening as well? Has that entered into your calculus?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, excellent question. I'm going to try to not spend another 45 minutes on oil demand, although I could. But let me give you the highlights. And I'm going to focus a little bit more on the U.S. We can take it global, but let me just walk you through the U.S. So one of the things that's astonishing is last year, the U.S. relied on oil, not forget imported oil and stuff, oil, for the lowest share of total energy since basically World War II, more or less. Right. So the share of oil in the energy mix is really coming down. Okay. And so if you look at, you know, at the same time as you have this huge growth in production, there's a huge destruction of demand. For the most part, this demand is driven by substitution, right? In the residential, commercial sectors, that's mostly towards gas. In the industrial sectors, it's mostly gas, a little bit of biofuels. And in transportation, it's also largely towards biofuels. So I think part of what you're seeing is, and this goes to a broader question of what the demand does. So over the last 6 or 7 years, you've seen a huge response, at least in the United States, to high oil prices. And this response took a number of manifestations. One was the switch to gas, right? So anyone who could switch to gas. Right? So share of gas in the economy is really growing. Share of oil is falling. The second thing that happened is airlines, flying became much less pleasant because fuel costs are a high part of total cost, and so airlines are flying at really high utilization, right? So if you get bumped off a plane because plane is full, you can blame oil for that. The other thing that happened is the driving patterns of Americans changed. And what you really saw there is it's not so much people stopped driving, is actually there was a real switch in vehicle ownership, right? And incredibly, and again, we don't really need to get too much into this, although I find it fascinating. There was a huge number, I think it was about 1.5, 1.7 million vehicles coming off the fleet in a sort of 4 or 5 year period, and there were 1.3 million motorcycles coming onto the market. So you have some real switches in terms of how people commute, how people drive, and so that affects the price of oil. It also affects sort of demand, right? Because if you buy a more fuel-efficient car because of high oil prices, when prices go down, sure, you can drive a little bit more, but the more fuel-efficient car is still in the system, right? So you can't go back unless you turn over the capital, you buy a different car. So all these things are really part of the equation. When you think about the global market, the overall pattern is lower demand for oil in the United States, lower demand for oil in Europe, where a lot of the same things are happening, lower transportation use, more public transport, more fuel-efficient vehicles. Also, you have much higher taxation of oil products. So the global pattern is lower oil demand in OECD countries, and then higher oil demand in non-OECD countries. That's mostly China, India, but also the Middle East. And what's really tricky there, and this is the last thing I'm going to say about this, is, especially when you go to the Middle East and also some other non-OECD countries, the price that consumers pay has nothing to do with Brent, right? What you pay to fill up your car in Saudi Arabia has nothing to do with Brent, right? Same thing in Venezuela, same thing in parts of the Middle East, same things in parts of Southeast Asia. And I think that's crucial because basically governments subsidize the price of gasoline. So why does this matter? It matters because, the price of oil can fall 50%, but no consumer is going to drive more because the price that they pay is exactly the same. Instead, before it was subsidized at 80%, now it's subsidized at 40%. But as a consumer, you're paying the same price. So the reason that's important is because there's a lot of demand out there that doesn't experience prices the way that Americans experience prices or the way that Europeans experience prices, which is you look at WTI, you look at Brent, and if a week later, 2 weeks later, you can see those changes at the pump. A lot of the world doesn't operate that way. A lot of the world has a number of taxes or subsidies or restrictions or bans that sort of limit the changes in the oil price to the changes in the fuel, the end user price. And so when you talk about, how much demand is there going to be because of lower oil prices, in a lot of places it doesn't matter because the consumer isn't seeing a change. The only change is in government finances. Then instead of subsidizing $1 billion, now you're subsidizing $500 million, right? So that, again, makes it much harder to understand exactly where you're going because you have to aggregate a lot of things that aren't necessarily very clear. And so that's how we think about the nexus between supply and demand.
Senator Dunleavy, follow up.
Thank you. And we also, I don't think, discussed, and you probably factored in, but we didn't discuss the actual, not just change in behaviors, but the efficiencies that were produced as a result, technological efficiencies over time that have actually saved energy. So, big question, how does this environment impact investment in Alaska's North Slope from today going forward, in your opinion?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, let me answer on the gas side first, and then we can talk about oil, and I'll probably solicit the help of Janik on this. Just letting me know so you can prepare an answer while I speak. I think on the Alaska LNG project, if you believe that this is the world that we live in, if you believe that 40 to 50 is the long-term price, and in large part, that depends on whether you think this line can keep growing, right? Because if this line can keep growing, if basically the supply is not unlimited, but there's plenty more, then maybe that is your new world. I think that makes the economics for an Alaska LNG project very difficult, right? Because it's a more expensive project, lower commodity environment. If you think about oil linkage in Asia, you know, at a $50 barrel oil, you may get, you know, $6 or $7 gas. At that price in Asia, AKLNG I think will struggle to compete, right? At the same time, as we said, first gas is expected in 2024-25, and it's a 20-year project. And I can tell you in general, you have quite a lot of players, in particular ExxonMobil, that, you know, if I think of one company that defines long-term, it's ExxonMobil, right? I remember in 2009 when the price crashed, 2008 when the price crashed with Lehman and everything, you know, they came out in December just like everyone was panicking, running around for cover. They came out and said, oh yeah, we're going to expand this refinery in Europe. And everyone's like, what are you guys talking about? It's like, well, you know, we do things for the long haul and we don't really pay attention to the price of oil today. So I think that's an asset. The other thing that's an asset for Alaska is that you're playing with some big boys that have deep pockets, right? If you were partnering with smaller companies, it's not that they wouldn't want to do it. They probably just wouldn't have the cash to do it. Now, this stage is fine, right? You're talking about $400-500 million for the pre-feed among five players. You know, it's affordable. Next stage feed, you know, gets a little bit higher, maybe a couple of billion dollars. I think you're in a real advantage that on the gas side, you have players with deep pockets who can really afford to pay that kind of money. What really happens when prices collapse is companies really go back to their budgets and they try to cut things. I would say the answer to how it affects the gas side, I think, is just too soon to tell. I don't think a six-month drop is sufficient to halt progress on the project. I would say if you had a sustained period and sort of the consensus was that, you know what, the consensus among the oil companies, the consensus among the state is that, hey, we think this is for the long haul. The new world is, you know, $50 to $60. You would have to see a real drop in costs, you know, because people don't drill as much, and costs for AKLNG coming down in order to move forward. So that would be how I would think about that. And I don't know if Janik wants to add something on the oil side.
Sure. For the record, Janik Mayer, Analytica. I would add to what Nikos has said, solely building on the contrast you just drew in terms of size of company in some of the lower 48 players versus Alaska, that one also needs to think about the contrast between the nature of the investment cycle in both of those places, right? Part of the reason what Nikos has said about the need to look at the diffusion of different players in the lower 48 and the point at which there is suddenly a price response to falling oil prices and when production is cut is because, unlike many other forms of production around the world, in principle, production from some of the lower 48 players is actually very quickly responsive to falling prices because it's an area where the question is not, as it is here on the North Slope, you know, how do I build a project that's going to produce X thousand barrels a day? How many years is it going to take to permit this, to build facilities, to eventually bring it online? The question is, how many wells do I drill next month, next quarter, next 6 months, next year? And those are all wells with steep decline curves that need to constantly be replaced by new stock of wells in order to maintain production. So the nature of investment decision-making in those plays is very, very different to the nature of investment decision-making on the North Slope, where it's about spending billions of dollars by a couple of players to build enormous facilities, drilling pads, bring big projects online that are going to produce for the next decade or more, right? And that, in many ways, is a huge advantage for Alaska in the current price environment because the fundamental nature of the decisions that are being made are not about the next 6 months, the next year. They're about the next decade and longer. And so it seems to me there are two big advantages Alaska has in the current price environment when we come to taking the long-term view on investment, and that is, as Nikos says, having big players that make decisions about these things in a fundamentally different way company executives that make it a point of pride actually not to know what the oil price is on any given day, because that's really not what drives their decisions. And the second is actually also having a fiscal system that in some ways actually looks very competitive at these prices, right? Places like North Dakota, where you have a very high, relatively high fixed royalty, looked incredibly competitive at $100 a barrel plus, because they're aggressive systems where the share of tax gets less and less and less as prices go down. At lower prices, Alaska actually looks very attractive, and I think those two things will serve Alaska well in terms of ongoing investment, as long as what we see in the future isn't, you know, years and decades of oil where they are now, but that at some point over the next many years, prices do at some point come back. If what we have ahead of us is decades of this, there's a different answer to that question. But relatively speaking, I think Alaska is well positioned in terms of long-term investment.
Senator Dunleavy, follow-up, followed by Senator Bishop, Senator Kelly, and Senator Michiki. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just a comment. I keep going back to your scalable, diffuse, and variable. As one thing that just keeps resonating in my mind, and I don't know if it's been answered yet, and I'd like to for you to see if you have a comment, is I think that the jury is still out on these fracking operation as far as reservoir capacity and how long it they can produce, right? Because I know from well stimulation, et cetera, et cetera, it's kind of uncharted waters to a degree. And if you could answer that, then I'll do a follow-up.
Senator Bishop, yes, it is uncharted waters. We don't know. We haven't been producing long enough to know. The only thing I would caveat to that is when I put on, and there's always a clash in the world of oil between economists and geologists, and there was a time around 2007 that I thought the geologists had the upper hand because prices were through the roof. There was no supply response. But eventually the economists came back with a vengeance. So my answer to that is, yes, we don't know about the geological properties. What we do know is that this is a market that for all its imperfections works. And when the price goes up enough, people are going to do new things to try to do this. And this is, if I can just add one more comment, this is the only place, not the only place, but one of the few places in the world where the oil market really operates as a market, where if you have more higher prices, you know, you can't go to Saudi Arabia and say, hi, I'd like to drill a little bit more oil, right? That's not how it works. A lot of places you can't do that. This is the only place in the world where you can do that at this scale. And so this, I think, underscores that in the grand scheme of things, this is a market that works. And when prices go up, people can respond.
So, and just a quick follow-up, since we're having, and it's a great discussion, and I like having it. And so last night, and I'm sure everybody at this table, including yourself and the people in the room, are reading night and day on the comments on oil prices, where they're at, where they're going, et cetera, et cetera. So last night, I read an article coming out of the kingdom, out of the House of Saud, that says that the floor, this could be it. And oh, by the way, if we don't ramp up production, oil could go back to $200 a barrel. That was last night. You know, so you got all these divergence of opinions, you know. I'm just saying that it is what it is, right? Everybody's got one, so.
Comment. Senator Bishop, I think it's fair to say that anyone can write anything and put it out on the web. Senator Kelly.
It's good for Bethel. Two questions. One is, could you talk a little bit about India? Because, I mean, obviously so much of the shock in oil prices has to do with China, and yet India was expected to be have a huge boom, which is kind of happening slowly, more slowly than it did in China. So could you talk a little bit about how the future of India might impact this by increasing demand? And the second thing is, given that I know it's difficult to answer the question because of the particularly because of the diffuse and variable aspect of those fields, what is the price? You know, we talked earlier that Saudi's strategy was to get the price down low enough that it breaks North Dakota, essentially. And the number I heard thrown around was $35 to $40, given that it is difficult to give an absolute answer to that because of what we've just learned today. What do you think about that price?
Senator Kelly, through the chair, let me answer the second one first. I'll go back to India. I think the 35 to 40, in my mind, would be at the lower end of that. I mean, I think with the floor is being potentially a little bit higher. That's why I said 40 to 50. Mm-hmm. But the key thing is, I think the way to understand Saudi Arabia and OPEC is they're asking the exact same question that you're asking. And their answer is, you know what? There's one way to figure it out.
Produce more.
Let the market play, right? Rather than calling up all our consultants and try to have them model things, the best way to find out what the floor is let the market play out and see when people start going bankrupt and cutting production. So I think the strategy, I think in part, is not necessarily a strategy to drive U.S. production out of the market. It's a strategy to really understand what this new beast looks like, right? And their sense is, look, this is a price discovery period. We're trying to figure out what's going on because no one knows what's going on. And so they're willing to pay a price for that, right? So that's how I think about the price. To go back to your first question in India, in general, India always sort of lags behind when you think about the oil market in particular. You know, China and the Middle East have been huge growth areas, far outpacing sort of what India has contributed to the market. I think the question for India, Indian oil, is in some ways a question about, you know, Indian political economy, Indian economic growth, reforms, and a lot of things that have to happen within India to really accelerate and bring forward the next wave of economic growth. Having Janak next to me, I'm going to try to not say too much on that. I can tell you that, to me, that's how I think about that, right, which is a more question of political economy. You have huge questions about fuel pricing. So one of the challenges is, as you go through this economic growth period, is, you know, you have to address fuel subsidies. So you may have economic growth, but because you're removing subsidies, price of energy goes up, and so the growth plus is offset by demand minus because of higher prices. So I think of energy and a particular oil demand in India as, you know, has a lot more potential than where it's currently at. And I wouldn't be surprised if you saw them become a much greater locomotive of growth. I certainly think of that in energy overall. In gas, it's true. In oil, it's true. They're really short on energy in general that they could use a lot more of.
Co-Chairman Kelly, follow-up?
No, that's fine.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you think about the business model of the North Slope of Alaska versus the Permian, Eagleford, and Bakken models, right? Many, many companies, many smaller companies versus major producers, and a prayer for some production from smaller companies on the North Slope. And we look at our credit issue with those that aren't producing, and again, there goes that prayer that someday we'll see a better mix. So the question I have is on the mix of companies with deeper pockets and a long game, like you talked about, you know, Exxon, the Exxons of the world, you often don't see much of a difference on funding for future projects when prices are low. They're looking 20 years out versus smaller, more speculative companies. Do you see a future in Alaska where there'd be a healthy mix that does include realistic production from smaller companies? And in your mind, what does that mix look like?
Senator Machicki, through the chair, and I think that might be also a really good way to transition to the second part of the presentation, which is about tax credits, which was the original topic, although I know that the oil market is always very fascinating. The one thing I would just caveat to that statement is, I don't think you can talk about what we call competitive landscapes or who operates and how big they are and how many players are without talking about geology, right? And I think those two things are sort of inseparable. So I don't think you could have, I mean, maybe it's possible geologically, I'm not sure. I don't think you could have, you know, 50 companies operating Prudhoe Bay, right? It's not quite the same thing. One of the reasons why it works in uncommercial gas is because there isn't a lot of permeability. Things are a lot more fragmented and small, and people are just drilling individual wells rather than having this massive reservoir. I mean, we may talk about the Eagle Ford, quote unquote, but if you look at the Eagle Ford, it's really a very fragmented, really spread out place. So I think there's an inherent limit to how competitive, how many companies you can have, that is driven by geology, right? In Saudi Arabia, you're not going to have Galwar, which is the biggest oil field in the world, operated by 10 different companies, because it doesn't make sense to do that. So I think there's definitely a pathway to getting, you know, more companies involved, having different players try different things. But there's an inherent limit, I think, in geology, and probably even just overall environment, market access, all these things, size, that I don't think you will get to a point of having, you know, 50, 60 operators and such a spread out production, because I don't think the geology is conducive to that. So with that, unless there's some questions on the broader oil market, I think we wanted to go to the credits. Oh, sorry.
Senator Machicki.
I think I clarified the difference in models, but do you see sort of a blending where some smaller players may become more productive and actually be, whether it's 15% or 20% in North Slope production, where they do have a future? So we'll talk about credits in just a moment. But I, when we think about this environment and where we are right now in Alaska's budget, we certainly have to think about that. Or do you see a model in Alaska that involves more productivity from some smaller players, although it won't be 60, maybe 6? But what is your long view on realistic production from smaller players?
Senator Machicki, through the chair, if I could take a stab at that, and for the record.
Mr. Mayor.
Janik Mayor, Analytica. I mean, I think obviously a large part of the last decade is a story of some of that transformation starting to happen on the North Slope, whether that's with the pioneers, now Kalis, with Eni, with the sorts of things that Repsol and Armstrong have been doing. Any number of additional players that have been coming up to the slope, and that's still in many ways in its nascent form, but I think we've seen a lot of movement already on that in the last decade, and there are a lot of reasons to think that given the right conditions that will continue, and that slowly there will be a building of the overall contribution made to total Alaska production by companies that are not just the big three.
Senator Machicki? If I could take a moment for Alaskans, those in this building and outside, if you go to the State of Alaska website and you go into basis for this committee, you'll find the documents that are being referred to today. There's one that's a PowerPoint that will be part of, that ties into two different pieces that are also online. Oil in 2015, Understanding the Market, is posted there, and what we're moving into is a report or an overview that you can reach, impact of Alaska oil and gas tax production credits at low oil prices, and then there's the PowerPoint there. So if Alaskans are following and want additional information or missed a particular point, the documents that are being referred to today are listed there. Any further comments or questions from committee members as we transition into the next portion of the presentation? If not, please continue.
So that was the macro picture on oil prices and how it is that we are where we are, and we now sort of come to focus on what those low oil prices today mean for the state of Alaska and the state of Alaska's budget. Obviously, it's a difficult and painful story at the moment, and in that context, there's been a lot of discussion in recent weeks, essentially about the bottom two lines of the table that are on screen at the moment. Question of, in these low oil prices, particularly looking out at the FY 2015 and FY 2016, I should apologize, by the way, we don't look out to the 22nd century. These the should read 2015 and 2016, not 2105 and 2106. what that outlook looks like for the next 2 years based on current Department of Revenue forecasts for price and spending levels. In terms of revenue that the production tax system will generate and spending that will occur on tax credits. So in particular, those figures are, for instance, FY 2015, $524 million million dollars in revenue from the production tax system versus $625 million in spending on credits for potential purchase, and the fact that that second line is bigger than the first, and therefore that is effectively a net outflow of cash to the Treasury, is something that I think has quite rightly caused some concern, and that those are definitely concerning figures. But in presenting those and talking about them, I think it's important to clarify a number of things, and there was some discussion around this table yesterday on this, because if all you focus on are those two figures, without any further context, it seems to me, for instance, as a member of the general Alaskan public, it would be very easy to come to the conclusion, A, that somehow the tax system is not only not collecting tax from producers, but actually paying them out money, and B, that somehow, given, for instance, that 2 years ago the legislature passed tax reform, that somehow SB 21 is responsible for this situation. Both of those conclusions would be entirely incorrect, and I want to spend the early part of this presentation talking about why that's the case.
Senator Michicki, did you have a thought?
I just had it. I did, Madam Chair. It would have been helpful to see 17 and 18 just simply so that Alaskans could understand the difference on the sunsetting of the alternative exploration frontier basin and the small producer credits in 16. I mean, I think they'll see a change at that point.
Absolutely. Senator Michicki, through the chair, if you go two slides on,
okay.
Those are charted out to 2018, and you can see exactly that. Of course, as you go out into the future, there's also more uncertainty about the forecast because there are less projects that are currently forecast in the pipeline. So this question of how much of the decline is due to falling investment that just hasn't been had forecast or decisions made on it. But yes, your point is well taken.
Senator Michicki, follow up.
Just to follow up, I guess my point was that we understood the liability of the credits in Senate Bill 21 and did sunset most of the adverse effects that we're currently experiencing today. So,
Senator Michicki, that is absolutely correct, and a big part of what I have to present today is to focus both on that and on the things that Senate Bill 21 did on the revenue side that have actually greatly assisted the state in these current difficult times.
Mr. Mayor.
So the first thing to say is that on that first question of, you know, is this the case, for instance, that the producers are not paying production tax and actually receiving tax credits, the answer to that is simply and emphatically no. The reason for presenting this table in this form is to show the sort of, first of all, the high-level tax calculation to say that the way the Department of Revenue accounts for these things, there are two different sorts of credits that they account for. Credits used against a producer's tax liability, there's credits claimed by the large current producing companies, essentially. And those are accounted for not as spending, but as a reduction in revenue that occurs to the Treasury. And then credits for potential purchase. These are credits claimed by small companies that don't have a tax liability that under statute, the state actually will pay out in certain circumstances directly as a refunded tax credit to those companies. Those are accounted for as spending rather than as revenue. So when we look at that line of production tax revenue, for instance, of $524 million in 2015, that's a number that is net of all credits that have been claimed by producing companies. The biggest component of that, of course, is the sort of variable dollar per barrel credit that at current low oil prices is about $8 per barrel. I think it's important to say, for instance...
Janet, can I interrupt you just for a moment?
Mr. Mayor, thank you. Senator Kelly.
You said the 2.5 was the net number?
Yes.
Okay.
The 524 is the net number.
Or the 2.5.
So 2.5 in FY 2014, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Mayor, one of the conversations that may or may not be clear to Alaskans is when we use the word producer, Alaskans, at least those that I talk to or those that contact my office, think producer means three companies. and that it's exclusive of other companies. And when we talk about it and we use just the term producers, sometimes, I don't want to say the water is muddy, but using the term producer brings to mind three large oil companies on our North Slope. While you're referring to producers today, those producers are inclusive of an overall tax structure that includes many taxpayers. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, that is indeed correct.
I just wanted to point that out because we have a bit of confusion on the use of the word producers. And so these are taxpayers, and they run from the North Slope all across Alaska. They're not just North Slope producers. They're Cook Inlet producers. There are explorers, I hope, in the Fairbanks area and in the interior. Is that fair?
Madam Chair, that's fair. The distinction I would draw is to say that overwhelmingly the bulk of the state's revenues overall and through the production tax system specifically come from large producers. There are other smaller producers that are earlier in the stage of development where they may have some tax liability but it's limited, and the credits they can claim, for instance, may frequently take up most of that tax liability or even in some cases mean that they are a net recipient of funds through the tax system. And there are other smaller producers still that have not yet come to production, for instance, that actually are net recipients through the tax system. But the distinction in that sense is in particular between large and small or producers and or companies that have yet to come to production.
Thank you. Senator Bishop, did you have a thought? Please continue.
The other point I'd make here is that in lots of ways when we talk about those credits used against tax liability, and I think this was a point also made by Commissioner Designee Hoffbeck yesterday, that it's in some ways even a misnomer to refer to some of these as credits. They're things that are an integral part of the tax system. The dollar per barrel credit in particular is what I'm talking about here, which in some ways is better sort of thought of as an alternate means of implementing the progressivity that existed under ACEs in a way that avoids some of the worst aspects of progressivity under ACEs. But it's thinking about it as a credit in terms of money that's somehow being handed back to companies is incorrect. This is simply a feature of the tax system that is intentionally designed to reduce the tax level at oil price, at lower oil prices. But as I say, the big takeaway here is that there are really two fundamental flows here. One is of revenue through the production tax system from major producing companies, and then of outlays that are, in many cases, investments in future production and future revenue that are being made as credits primarily to, in fact, entirely paid out to smaller companies that are developing for future production. On the question of the impact of the passage of Senate Bill 21 on this entire situation, and I will come in a subsequent slide to the question of what Senate Bill 21 did in terms of trying to sunset a number of credits, but it also did something that I think is very important to really understand in the current environment, which is to do a lot to much better protect the state's finances on the revenue side in times of low oil prices. And to really make that point, I thought it's worth sort of working through some of the high-level tax calculation to understand what that looks like under Senate Bill 21 and, very roughly speaking, what that might have looked like were ACEs still in place in the current not only low oil price but high investment scenario, because it's the combination of those two things that puts such a strain on the revenue stream from the production tax system. This, of course, is should be a familiar-looking table because it's taken from, I think it's table E, if I'm not mistaken, from the appendices of the Revenue Sources book, where the Department of Revenue presents a sort of high-level, indicative example working of the tax calculation, treating essentially the tax system as though, rather than multiple different companies, we had just one producer on the slope accounting for everything. That's obviously an abstraction. That's not what is really the case. And there are details that are important that one misses in not treating different companies separately. So this doesn't give you an accurate, necessarily perfectly final example of what actual revenues would be. But it's a very useful way of stepping through at a high level and understanding how the tax system works and how different structures, relatively speaking, would have worked. So obviously, overall, it's a profit-based system where we start with revenues, subtract out costs, transportation, lease expenditures, etc., and then come to some sort of net value of production tax value that we then assess under different systems in terms of what would be generated through the tax system. So the overall focus of my comments here are going to be sort of on the final six lines of the table in terms of what tax and what credits might have existed under each system. So if we start broadly speaking with $12.5 billion of revenue from production, net out a certain amount in $1.5 billion in transportation costs, $7 billion in lease expenditures, we come down to what would be useful. Use the laser pointer here. To a production tax value in both of these cases of about $3.7 billion in terms of the total taxable value under either ACES or SB 21 of what is produced net of costs on the North Slope. In terms of the differences between the way ACES and SB 21 work, of course, there's a 35% base rate under SB 21, a 25% base rate under ACES, and in this low price and high investment environment, ACES progressivity no longer affects any of these calculations, so it's simply a comparison between those two base rates. Creating before credits, and this includes before that dollar per barrel credit I was discussing, these two figures of either $1.3 billion or $950 million in taxes before credits under either system. If we look at the numbers in the revenue sources book, we then we'll skip over for the moment lines 2 and 3 and come back to those in a second, take out $720 million in credits against that tax liability claimed by the producing companies on the North Slope. That matches up essentially with these figures. The 750 is for the state, statewide, around 720 on the North Slope, and again about the sort of $1.3 billion in tax revenues before credit. So that's how those line up. After that comes out, we end up with around $600 million in total tax after credits under SB 21 in FY 2015 by that calculation. If we think instead about what might have happened under ACES, we would have started with this lower initial tax base, then taken out a certain amount in capital credits that SB 21 did away with. Those in FY 2015, if we take simply total capital spending for 2014, for 2015, blend them and take a 20% capital credit rate, that gives us a number of about $720 million. Once you subtract that out, you're left only with $224 million in tax revenue. So only a little over a third of the revenue under ACES that SB 21 would give us based on revenue sources book forecasts for 2015. If we take that out to FY 2016, the picture is an even starker difference where, again, based on the even lower forecast oil prices in FY 2016, revenues through the production tax system of $286 million under SB 21, and this negative number you see here for ACES. Now, it's important to note that large producers can't go negative in their tax liabilities under ACES or under either system, but that would be essentially negative unclaimable credits that those companies could get transferable tax credit certificate for and claim against their tax liabilities in future years. So not only effectively would ACES, if the forecasts for FY 2016 come true, not have created any revenue before any spending on reimbursable credits to other companies, not have created any revenue for the state in FY 2016, it would actually have generated a liability that would be paid out to those companies against their tax liability in future years. So just how much better the state is under SB 21 versus ACES in these low price environments, I think, is very, very important to understand.
Mr. Mayor, thank you. You've generated several comments, first by Senator Bachicki, then by Senator Hoffman, and I did see Senator Dunleavy at least bristle. So I'm not sure if he has a question, but we'll start with Senator Bachicki.
So, Mr. Mayor, just to clarify for Alaskans, what you're saying is the difference between Senate Bill 21 versus ACES and FY 15 is about a $380 million difference that went into the state coffers that would not have had we been under ACES. And you're saying the difference in FY 16 between Senate Bill 21 and ACES is about $529 million into the state coffers that would have not gone in that direction, and the total is close to a $1 billion difference.
Senator Mashiki, through the chair, that is absolutely correct. The one point I would make on that is that that is the case when you consider that liability for FY 2016 and its impact on future years of revenues, because it's not a direct FY 2016 impact of half a billion, it's a direct impact of a quarter, with the rest of that being impacted as an ongoing liability essentially for future years. But yes, Senator Mashiki, through the chair, you're absolutely correct.
Senator Mashiki, follow-up?
Just to follow-up, so your estimation in a low-price environment, which we're expecting for the foreseeable future, is this was a very healthy move, not only in the difference that's going into the general fund, but in encouraging, when we've essentially flattened the decline. We've seen a little bit of an increase, and it seems to be doing what we wanted it to do. And post-FY16, when the credits start falling off, if all things are the same, we're expecting a greater positive influence from the tax change. Is that correct?
Senator Mashiki, through the chair, I would, broadly speaking, agree with most of those comments. I, in particular, would focus on what I've said a number of times in the past, which is that, in many ways, ACES as a tax structure was a bet on high oil prices and low investment. And as long as those two scenarios held, it created enormous amounts of revenue for the state. It has always been the case that if prices ever fell and investment ever rose, that picture would very rapidly reverse, and that is exactly what we are seeing at the moment. I've always suggested that, you know, rather than a tax system that is focused on generating as much windfall as possible at the highest oil prices, the state would in the long run be better served by a somewhat rebalanced tax system that put a solid floor under the state's finances and low oil prices while having a more even split at higher price levels, still generating a lot of revenue for the state at higher price levels, but perhaps a more even split. And fundamentally, that rebalancing between better protecting the state at low levels while taking less at the top is fundamentally what SB 21 sought to do. And how that plays out at the low price level is exactly what you're seeing at the moment.
Thank you, Mr. Myers.
Madam Chair, before we do, I just want to take a pause, because I know on gavel to gavel there are a lot of reporters who are writing, getting their notes for the next story. And I want to make sure they have time to write down what they've just heard, because I think many of the members of the press have been fair on this issue, but many haven't. As a matter of fact, the people that are in this room have actually been pretty fair. But there are people watching, and I want the press to just absorb what was said that we've been saying all along, and yet it has been reported quite the opposite. So, let us move on.
Thank you, Senator Kelly. as under all tax regimes, everyone tries to do what's best for Alaska, and it seems that, per the presentation today, that as Senator Kelly and Senator Mashiki point out, the change in the tax structure has benefited Alaska enormously on our bottom line. But it does have a world environment that we're working in, and creating that investment opportunity in Alaska has been extremely important to help position us into the numbers that Senator Mashiki read into the record. Senator Mashiki, would you like to read those numbers one more time, just so that as far as the changes, at least, in what has been penciled out before us today, understanding, as our consultants have said, that it's based on, the comparison is based on low oil prices and increased investments versus the alternative.
So FY15 are based on actuals, and the difference, that the benefit to the state of Alaska of Senate Bill 21 over ACES brought $380 million additional dollars into state coffers, into the general fund, that would not have occurred under ACES. And the forward look on FY16 is assuming an additional $529 million under Senate Bill 21 than would have occurred under ACES. And if you add the two together, we're, you know, $920 million difference with what we know today. So a substantial benefit to the people of Alaska. And at the same time, we have flattened the decline. Actually, we're seeing somewhat of an increase. And I know the Department of Revenue talked to us the other day about estimated future increases. So from what we know today, it doesn't mean we won't look at Senate Bill 21 in the future as we allow it some time to play out. But from what we know today, the current tax regime under 21 seems to be doing what it was designed to do. And I think that's important for Alaskans to understand.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Thank you, Senator Kelly. Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you go over your reconciliation on line 4, the $30 million difference between that and the previous page and the $20 million in 15 and the $20 million in 16? How are those reconciled again?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair. So the $720 million here, and again, remember, this is the sort of abstracted, higher-level working, treating the workings of the tax system as though there were one monolithic taxpayer rather than the detailed reality that the Department of Revenue actually does of looking taxpayer by taxpayer and figuring out all the details that occur from the interactions of individual taxpayers and their liabilities. But overall, their figure from the revenue sources book is of $720 million. In credits claimed against liability for the North Slope. That compares with this previous figure of 750 for FY 2015. The source of that difference is this is a statewide figure and includes taxes claimed against liability in Cook Inlet, for instance, as well, versus 720, which is just for the North Slope, is the broad difference.
Thank you.
Thank you for pointing that out, Senator Hoffman. And again, we are trying to run examples. It is very difficult to run exacts because of the limited number of taxpayers in particular regions. So this is an aggregate look at the performance of two different systems. Is that fair, Mr. Mayor?
Madam Chair, that is entirely fair, yes.
Senator Dunleavy, followed by Senator Bishop, did you have a question?
Through the chair, thank you. So SB 21, a major component was going to be to provide a favorable investment environment because of our decline in production. The secondary item for SB 21 was, of course, to capture revenue on the low side of oil. And we know it's difficult to predict, but it's here. I guess it's more of a statement. So on the secondary issue, it's obvious, and you have the data in front of you, that we are capturing more revenue under SB 21 than ACES. I guess it's just a statement I'll make on the record that I'm hoping that the low oil prices do not have the oil companies rethink about investing their money in Alaska. I believe they will, and I'm just going to encourage them to keep doing that and fulfill the two components of SB 21. Because I know these difficult times when your bottom line shrinks a little bit for everybody. Some may be asking, will the investment still occur? And I'm confident that they will, but just want to get on the record that I think many Alaskans will still be watching that issue to make sure that those investments occur.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Are there a response, Mr. Mayor?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair. I would add to that simply sort of to reiterate what I said earlier under the oil price presentation in terms of the question of the outlook for future investment in Alaska in this environment, which is to say that even with these changes that were made at the lower end that to better protect the state's revenues at the lower end, relative to fixed royalty jurisdictions like North Dakota, at low oil prices, Alaska actually looks quite competitive on that front. And second, to say that Alaska is well served in that instance, as we were talking about, by both the nature of the investment opportunities here and by the large companies that make investments over a very long time horizon.
Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I thought it was very well your executive summary as we're talking about credits. And you wrote an interesting dynamic for me that's something I'd never thought about. And that is, it's maybe worth examining looking at other capital with the state's excellent credit rating is versus offering credits. It could be cheaper in the long run for us maybe to look at our other credit options for the state. And I just thought that was very, very well done. Thank you.
Mr. Mayor, if we could continue, I do plan on adjourning the Finance Committee meeting at 11. We have about 25 minutes left and a few slides to go. I'm not sure if each of the additional sides will create as much conversation, but let's go forward.
Madam Chair, very briefly to finish up on this slide, one further important point to understand, which is that the key thing that SB 21 did that makes this difference on the state finances is what it did to the way credits interact with the 4% gross minimum floor. That 4% gross minimum floor was already in the tax statute under ACES. The reality is, because of the way capital credits worked under ACES, that 4% floor was never really effectively binding. It was a 4% floor that applied to that line one of tax before credits, but capital credits then took you down below that 4% floor. So any substantial producer that was also making major new investments could take their tax liability substantially below that 4% of gross revenue floor on their tax liability. What Senate Bill 21 did was to say, well, we're getting rid of capital credits, we're replacing them instead with this dollar per barrel credit or allowance that reduces your tax liability at low price levels, but that dollar per barrel amount can't take you below the 4% floor.
Mr. Mayor, one of the issues during the tax debate had been connecting a tax credit with a barrel of oil. I think it was no production, or I'm not sure what the slogan was. But have we tied a credit to a barrel of production that Alaska Seas sold on our behalf before that credit's applied? Or is it part of the formula that it flows through before we value that barrel?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I entirely understand the question. We've created a dollar per barrel credit of a variable amount that is essentially attached to each barrel that is produced. More than anything, I would reiterate what I said earlier, which is that while that is notionally a dollar per barrel credit and perhaps to some extent an incentive for production, more than anything, what it is simply a feature of the tax system that exists to reduce the tax rate in lower price environments and is in many ways exists to do what progressivity did under ACES, but with less of the adverse effects that progressivity had.
Co-Chairman Kelly, followed by Senator Dunleavy.
So is it correct to say no production, no credit?
Senator Kelly, through the chair, yes, that is indeed absolutely correct. At least for major producers that claim those credits, yes.
Through the chair, we've talked about the benefits of SB 21 in this environment. Is there any advantage of ACES, any aspect of ACES in this environment that we're overlooking?
Thinking about that because I want to make sure, Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, that I give it adequate thought before answering. But I think that if one were designing a tax system for a harvest environment to generate as much revenue as possible when prices are high and investment is low, ACES was a very good tax system for doing that. As a tax system for times when prices are lower, and in particular one either that incentivizes new investment or that generates adequate revenue when new investment is occurring, ACES was not good at that, and that is the environment we find ourselves in now.
Thank you.
Senator Kelly.
It isn't my desire to just sit here and trash ACES, but ACES did not have a credit associated with production. Is that correct?
Senator Kelly, that's correct.
So I'm not sure how that would ever be an advantage when you need production, whether prices are high or low. Can you explain? Could you flesh that out a little more?
Mr. Mayor.
Senator Kelly, through the chair, I would draw a distinction. I mean, on the one hand, Senate Bill 21 got rid of the capital credit under ACES and to some extent replaced it with this dollar per barrel amount that is tied to production. I think it's really important to understand that while there is that similarity and replacement of one with the other, there are also, in many ways, two very different things. Okay. Capital credits under ACES existed as a means of state support for spending, and essentially as a means of saying, well, we're going to take a lot of revenue on the high side, and in order to improve project economics, we're going to provide some cash up front to reduce your development costs. That's essentially the way that ACES worked. The way SB 21 works is to say, we're going to take less of the actual revenues when they occur. We will have this dollar per barrel credit, but fundamentally that's about saying we want to reduce the tax rate when prices are lower. But because we're taking a bit less, we don't need to mount up the cash up front to help you with your development costs.
Okay.
And to be fair, what ACES has done for us is put a lot of money in reserves. Absolutely. And given us an opportunity to have this discussion, encourage development on North Slope, create investment opportunities so that we are not in harvest mode and that we do have oil that can come into the pipeline that is currently being being looked at and worked on by new explorers, both small explorers and larger producers, which was what the people of Alaska asked us to do as we go forward. So as we look at the mechanics of both, they, as our consultants have described, they were two very different economic drivers. Under the ACES system, in harvest mode, we were extracting as much as we could and placing that money as much as we could in the bank. Under this scenario, we are trying to extend a field that has great potential and bring the best value for Alaskans to the table over a longer period of time. So, I don't want to characterize that for the committee, so I'll make those my words as understanding that, but there are two different environments, and our consultants have been tried to be fair about there were different things at play. Co-Chairman Kelly.
Is it correct to, would it be a correct characterization to say that under ACES you actually incentivized harvest mode? Let me rephrase that. Would it be unreasonable to say you incentivized harvest mode under ACES?
Senator Kelly, through the chair. There are aspects of that I would agree with, but I would like to head to what I say a little and say that, you know, ACES also provided substantial incentives for capital spending, which in principle should encourage reinvestment. I think that was a lot of the hope and the purpose when ACES was designed, that those would. I think the overall balance between the amount that ACES took at the high end, and in particular what that meant because high oil prices had the impact that they had in terms of stimulating investment in the lower 48 that never flowed up here because those prices never really accrued to Alaskan investors. So I think because of that, ACES didn't create the reinvestment that people initially hoped it would when it was put in place, and to that extent may have further encouraged harvest. But I wouldn't want to go quite as far as your statement.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As we look at the past, and we're here in the present, I want you to think about what's going to happen in the future. Let me just characterize it from my standpoint. The oil tax rate was revamped back in 1989 by, I think it was Commissioner Williams back then, who was Department of Revenue Commissioner. And ACES was a response to that. And Senate Bill 21 was a response when you had a pro-oil governor who knew the industry well. Senate Bill 21 was a response to ACES. As we go through this time now and we have a different administration, how do we protect Alaska's revenues during the next phase? Do you have any idea? Do you understand the question, first of all? And do you have any idea on where we could go down that direction so that we do indeed look at, as was pointed out, the wisdom of putting Senate Bill 21 in place of ACES because of, as the co-chair pointed out, harvest mode mentality that was there, and certainly had its benefits, as was pointed out by the other co-chair. Where do you see us going? Or what kind of advice do you have for us to watch out for?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I think the first thing I would say is that probably the biggest disadvantage Alaska has from the entire history that you mentioned is that of the instability that all of that created, right? As we've talked about, the nature of the investment opportunities up here are very long-term ones for companies with deep pockets to make investments that pay off over years and decades, and in many cases multiple decades. Mm-hmm. When you make those sorts of investments, what is important to you more than anything is not even so much how much tax you pay and the nature of the tax system, but that you know it's stable and that it isn't going to change over time, and that you aren't going to make a decision on one day to commit billions of dollars of capital based on a certain model of what the future looks like, and then a year or two in find that everything has changed once again. So I would suggest more than anything after, as Senator Austin through the chair, you rightly point out that history of ongoing changes to the tax system, that more than anything what Alaska would benefit from in terms of investment in the future is as much stability as it can create. I think there are things that could be done, for instance, in terms of some of the coming slides looking at the ongoing outlay of credits into the future, that might provide some of the same benefits to companies at less cash outlay to the state, and those things might be worth at least examining in greater detail. But as far as the overall picture of the tax system, more than anything, I would suggest that stability is the most important thing the state could provide.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we don't want to get into the debate of the pros and cons because we're living with the current system, but harvest mode to me is trying to get as much oil out of the ground as possible for the maximum benefit of our Constitution. That is required. But the arguments for changing it was to reverse the downtrend. We're seeing some changes slowing that down, but it was to level it off and to change the curve. And at high prices, ACES worked differently than and brought in more revenue, as you pointed out. At lower prices, which we don't want to be at, it brings in the current regime brings in more. But Kuparuk and Prudhoe Bay are in their latter stages of their development. We're hoping to find, with this program, incentivize development to find and turn around the curve. It's too early to tell if that's going to happen. Everybody in Alaska wants that. So for me, the jury's still out as to if that is going to happen.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Well said. We all would like to see more production. We have about 10 minutes left. If we could continue through the slide deck.
Madam Chair, I will do my best to make haste. Broadly speaking, this then is the outlook of presented in terms of Department of Revenue Sources book figures for the next 4 years in terms of what these credits look like. So in the yellow, this question of credits used against the tax liability, primarily the dollar per barrel credit used to reduce the tax rate in low prices for large producers with a liability. And then in green, credits for purchase by the state, that is outflow, spending outflow by the state on credits to small producers who are developing new resources. The first thing to point out is in that, again, looking at those FY 2015 and 2016 numbers, you'll see just how dramatically that figure falls. And that is exactly what we were looking at on the previous page, which is the 4% gross minimum that SB 21 made binding kicking in, and actually in exactly the time frame we're looking at, very substantially reducing the credit outflow by the state through that fixed floor. The next thing to say is that we do have some of the highest level of credits for purchase by the state, cash outflow being spent on providing support for development spending by small companies, largely an investment in future production and future tax revenue. That's a function of overall spending, both on the North Slope and in Cook Inlet, being the highest it's been in a very long time, possibly. Well, yeah, so in going back some time. That falls off in the future years, as I said before. We will see how much that's a function of simply of not having the projects in the pipeline. There is certainly, though, some impact of other things SB 21 did that Senator Shiki made reference to earlier. That is the sunset for a number of credits. This is not something that SB 21 did explicitly by taking action, but rather legislators looking at what was already in statute, which was a number of tax credits that were due to sunset, and saying, rather than extend them as we might otherwise, actually we think it's important that we let these sunset because we want to reduce the overall credit liability to the state in the future, particularly in low oil prices. So those are things like the alternative credit for exploration, the frontier basin credit, the small producer credit, all set to sunset in 2016. Small producer credit will have some liabilities associated with it beyond that, because it applies to any producer that essentially took sanction on a project or that started producing before 2016 and has a 9-year tail. But collectively, if we again look at the revenue sources book numbers, those credits accounted for $113 million of spending in FY 2014, and as time goes, we will see the impact of SB 21 and taking those out of the system. There's one other thing to point out, which is taking out the capital credit. SB 21 was essentially trying to reduce the overall level of government support for spending by companies from the very, very high levels that it had under ACE as part of that rebalancing the tax system. Because that has a significant impact on small producers who were relying on some of that support for spending, it introduced a sort of transitional arrangement between now and 2016 to say that, first of all, it took the 25% carried forward annual loss credit, increased that to 35% to make it the same as the tax rate, which is how that is supposed to be set up. But temporarily, it also raised it to 45% until January 1st of 2016 to say that, well, under ACEs, small producers had essentially 45% government support for spending between a 20% capital credit and a 25% carried forward annual loss credit, purely as a transition arrangement to make that reduction in support less harmful to those companies who had certain investment plans. We will keep that 45% level of support for government spending until January 2016 and then reduce it to the 35% level. So that, again, will take some of those credits paid out of the system into the future.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, for the chair, just briefly, could you propose to get a graph that carves out Cook Inlet credits versus credits on the slope, specifically for the slope?
Senator Dunleavy, my understanding is we can't do that because of the limited number of taxpayers that are available in those regions. We actually, my office actually made a request to the Department of Revenue to try to look more closely at those tax credits, and it would identify a taxpayer because of the amount of folks in the market. That's my understanding. I can absolutely go back and double check, but I'm not sure we can expose that information.
In response to that, Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, without going into any of those precise details for that reason, what I can say is my understanding is it's about half-half in terms of, for instance, the $600-odd million forecast to be spent by the state on credits paid out refundably through the tax system. About half of those are forecast to be spent on the North Slope, about half of those are forecast to be spent in Cook Inlet. And that's,
Mr. Mayor, if I might, and I believe that the Commissioner Designee of Revenue yesterday confirmed that it was about 50-50 on the number also. Thank you.
And that's an important point to, and an important distinction to draw, because credits on the North Slope, you know, are both an integral part of the tax system and remain in that sense an investment in future production tax revenue through the profit-based production tax that exists on the North Slope. Credits in Cook Inlet continue to exist in many ways. Cook Inlet is an interesting amalgam, shall we say, of tax regimes. The overall tax system that continues to exist in Cook Inlet is essentially not only SB 21 and not ACEs, but essentially from the perspective of the tax that is charged, continues to be ELF. That means a low and fixed tax on gas that's produced, and in most cases, essentially no tax on oil that is produced. Combined with that low level of taxation, we have a system of credits that is more ACEs than anything else. That is to say, the 20% capital credit that SB 21 took away on the North Slope continues to exist. There's a higher level of capital credit at a 40% level for well spending that never actually existed on the North Slope. And there's also the 25% carried forward annual loss credit. So there are a lot of credits there that, unlike on the North Slope, are not so much investment in future production tax revenue as they are simple subsidy to try to create more investment in future production. And obviously that has been very important for the state because of the reliance of South Central Alaska on Cook Inlet gas. But it's important to understand that really is directly in that sense a subsidy rather than an investment in future revenue, and that given the constraints the state finances faces at the moment, it may at least be worth considering whether there are other solutions that could provide some of the benefit that that subsidy currently creates, whether, for instance, in terms of using innovative financing options to create a similar benefit for producers at less cash cost to the state. So, for instance, where frequently it may be the case that those credits are used as collateral to enable debt financing for development. If there are cases, for instance, where that is the case, are there ways where the state's balance sheet could, and the strength of that could be used to provide a similar benefit substantially more efficiently at lower cost to the state?
Senator Machicki.
Just for the record, Madam Chair, I think it's an important statement to make, and I made the statement yesterday or the day before. There are two types of oil and gas production in the state of Alaska. Right, there's the production that is destined for the general fund on the North Slope, and there's the production that is destined for the furnaces, water heaters, and vehicle fuel tanks of Alaskans. Now, we're looking at solutions for Fairbanks as well from Cook Inlet right now. You'll be hearing more about that from our Energy Committee. But we were in crisis mode for the availability of reasonably priced natural gas energy for half the population of Alaska. We're hoping to include that to nearly three-quarters of the population of Alaska. And I'm not saying I'm not interested in looking at leveraging Alaska's savings on reducing the outlay of cash from the state in the future. But please keep that in mind. We have very different purposes. We were in crisis mode a very short time ago. Things are looking better, but I wouldn't say that we're out of the woods. So I think we have to look at those two production areas very differently. And I hope you can agree with that. You can comment, certainly, if you choose to.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Senator Hoffman.
Just a comment from my perspective. I'm looking for 100%, not moving from 50 to 75%, but 100% of Alaskans reducing their energy costs.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. We serve on a committee that's trying to provide that opportunity for all Alaskans. Mr. Mayor, we have about 2 minutes left and a couple slides. Are there some high-level takeaways? We have the slide deck. We have the backup documentation. We've made those available to Alaskans. But in 2 minutes, if you could just give us a high-level overview of what either is remaining or what you would like this committee to take away from your conversation today.
Madam Chair, that in fact concludes our comments. Our final slide is simply one of some high-level conclusions, simply to say, to draw from Nikos's presentation earlier, that the oil price drop we've seen is due to a combination of excess supply and bearish demand, that and OPEC acknowledging the reality that they can't manage this market and create the price that they want without losing substantial market share. That on the credit front, remember the big producers are still paying large sums of tax. It's not that money is somehow being shoveled back to them. That in this low price environment, the only issue is that when we look at the production tax alone and not at the much larger amount of revenue that comes through the overall fiscal system, that by itself doesn't cover the outlay from credits paid to small companies. SB21 placed a much more secure floor under the revenue side of the equation in this low oil price, high investment environment, as well as eliminating many credits, and that if one were to look at one specific area for further reductions in credit, Cook Inlet may be one place to look.
Thank you. Any closing comments from committee members? We have a meeting scheduled tomorrow morning, January 28th at 9. Senator Donnelly.
Pass.
At 9 a.m. tomorrow. With that, we're adjourned.